This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Web Messiahs over at squarespace.com. Go to squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to receive 10% off your first order for your beautiful, incredible, wonderful website. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. Except for inside the sun or outside of the gravity well that you're currently stuck on as you are slowly dissolved by the forces of time and space. Let's get going with today's episode with the amazing Jim Woodring. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Hello, super compressed storehouses of amnesic alien information disguised as ambling towers of sentient meat. It is I, Duncan Trussell, and you're listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. And recently, I came upon this amazing interview between Neil deGrasse Tyson on his podcast Star Talk and Edward Snowden. And I wanted to play a quick clip from this interview for you.
We're going to ask ourselves, how will an alien want to communicate with us, let's say? And let's say the civilization is intelligent or more intelligent than we are. They would find a pretty efficient way to send a signal to reduce the energy cost for them. Perhaps, I'm making this up, but it's not a stretch to imagine this. By doing so, they would try to find any reducible information in the signal they want to send us and represent that in some other kind of way that is less representative of information. Isn't that correct? Isn't that what they would want to do? Am I even saying that right?
You know, when you mention that, it brings up a really interesting idea, which is that, let's say, all societies that have open communications, they have communications over the air, under the ground, eventually discover that they need to encrypt their communications to protect them. So if you have an alien civilization trying to listen for other civilizations, or our civilization trying to listen for aliens, there's only one small period in the development of their society when all of their communications will be sent via the most primitive and most unprotected means. So when we think about everything that we're hearing through our satellites or everything that they're hearing from our civilization, if there are indeed aliens out there, all of their communications are encrypted by default. So what we are hearing that's actually an alien television show or, you know, a phone call or, a message between their planet and their own GPS constellation, whatever it happens to be, is indistinguishable to us from cosmic microwave background radiation.
That's really trippy to think about. The cosmic microwave background radiation is actually the encrypted communication of some super advanced civilization. But it gets even weirder when you consider the concept that perhaps this encrypted information is not stored within cosmic background radiation, but is actually encoded into you. That you are the encrypted storehouse of some kind of super advanced civilization, and that all you need is a key to unlock this encryption so that you could uncompress all the data stored within your being, and that that key can be found in a variety of different ways, including meditation practices, psychedelics, or some unknown method that we haven't even stumbled upon yet or that was lost after the last great cataclysm. Terence McKenna was one of the primary disseminators of the concept that mushrooms were in fact an alien communication, a kind of alien probe. And here's a clip from one of his lectures where he's talking about this.
As you know, the world's largest radio telescope is at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. And as you probably know, a multi-million channel analyzer has been attached to that thing, and there's been funding for another deep space search. And so there they are at Arecibo with the world's largest radio telescope reaching out, you know, mega Marubi sticks into the universe. When you actually go there, the telescope was built into a natural bowl, which they made further, they rounded out. And then they planted grass in this bowl to halt erosion. Well, then to keep the grass from getting out of hand, they brought in white cows to crop the grass. So they're in the grass beneath the world's largest radio telescope, engaged in searching for extraterrestrial life, is the mushroom in great profusion. If you wanted it, that's where you'd go and get it. And that is the perfect symbol for how we search for extraterrestrial life. It's at your feet, my friends.
Shit, maybe it's not at your feet. Maybe it is your feet. This is McKenna's version of the Sufi parable of Nasruddin and the donkey. Nasruddin was this trickster figure who, as the story goes, as the parable goes, would ride a donkey across the border every day. And the border guards, knowing Nasruddin was a mischievous trickster, would search the bags on the donkey's back, and all they would find is straw. And they couldn't figure out what was happening, but they knew Nasruddin was smuggling something. Day after day after day, he'd come across on a donkey, all the while getting wealthier and wealthier, until finally he retired in some nice house in some other country, and he ran into the customs officer, who was always giving him the pat down. And the customs officer said to Nasruddin, "You gotta tell me, Nasruddin, what was it you were smuggling?" And Nasruddin said, "I was smuggling donkeys." So maybe the aliens, like Nasruddin, are hiding their communication in plain sight. And the way they're hiding their information in plain sight is not by encoding it into cosmic microwave background radiation, but inside of you. Maybe human life is just encrypted alien information, and the pursuit of self-realization is that encrypted alien information trying to decode itself. Holy Jehovah, we've got a great episode today with artist Jim Woodring. We're going to dive right into it, but first, some quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the Weblords at squarespace.com. Go to squarespace.com and use offer code Duncan to get 10% off a sleek, beautiful, glistening, glorious, phosphorescent website that's guaranteed to carry your ideas into the minds of your species and transform the planet that you're currently existing on, if whatever the information is that you're trying to get out there is the kind that transforms planets. If not, at least it's a great web service that's going to allow you to avoid the dark pseudo-web designers that clitter and clatter in the dark corners of this wonderful civilization that we're currently existing in. These sons of bitches will destroy you if you're not careful. They will suck you into a kind of deadly undertow, and before you know it, you're going to wake up in the middle of the night with the narcotic secreting man boob of your pseudo web designer shoved into your mouth, spraying his mucousy spray into the back of your throat. This is bad news, friends, because once you suckle at the nipple of a pseudo web designer, you're going to get narcotized. You're going to get sedated. You're going to get mentally disabled. You're going to have a brain that looks like the rotting great brain of a football player in his 50s who's had hundreds of concussions, all from suckling that dark nectar known as the tsunami. It's the spray of darkness that comes from these bastards who will take your idea for your business, who will take your dreams, who will take whatever budget that you have to get your business out there on the internet, and they will transform it not from lead into gold, but from epiphany into diarrhea. And the next thing you know, you're going to have this stinky crap website sticking into the world wide web, and anyone who goes to it is going to take one look and say to themselves, "There's no fucking way that I'm going to work with this son of a bitch. Their website looks like pictures I've seen on the internet of dog cysts." You don't want that. And to avoid it, all you got to do is go to squarespace.com. You don't even need a credit card to sign up. You can check it out to make sure that it's right for you. But they've got some amazing features. It's a beautiful design. Yeah, it's simple and powerful. They've got 24/7 support via live chat and email. I have tested this to make sure that that is the case, because when you're building a website, it is nice to have someone that you can reach out to. If you get confused, it's only $8 a month and you get a free domain if you buy Squarespace for the year. They've got a responsive design. Your website scales to look great on any device, and every website comes with a free online store. Start a trial. No credit card is required. You can start building your website today, and definitely use the offer code Duncan to get 10% off your first purchase and to show your support for the podcast, because Squarespace has been one of my longest sponsors and they're real sweeties over there. So if you've been thinking about building a website, give it a try. If for whatever reason it doesn't work out for you, you have nothing to lose. You can sign up for free. You don't have to use a credit card, and you could just test the waters, but I guarantee you're going to like it. There's a lot of beautiful websites out there that have been created using Squarespace. Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. Speaking of you going places, I've got some upcoming tour dates that I wanted to let you know about. For those of you living in Australia, I'm going to be in Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, and Auckland. And these dates are going to be from November 4th to November 12th. I hope you guys will come out and see me. I'm also going to be in Atlanta at the Laughing Skull, October 15th through the 18th. All of these ticket links are up at duncantrussell.com. Come out and see a live show. Also, I hope you'll visit our shop located at duncantrussell.com. Pick up some t-shirts, a poster, or one of our amazing banners. They're all there for you. I want to thank all of you who continue to use our Amazon portal. If you go to the comments section of any of the podcasts at duncantrussell.com and click on that portal, the next time you're going through Amazon, we'll get a very small percentage of whatever it is that you buy. And I'm going to promote something here that you can get through Amazon that I recently bought. And it was one of those things, like, as I'm buying it, I'm like, this is an impulse buy. I'm fucking up. I know that I probably shouldn't pay this much money for it. I was feeling really weird, but I did it anyway. I bought a Big Green Egg, which is this convection oven grill thing. And my God, I can't even explain how much I love this thing. The combination of this grill with marijuana and wood chips is just, it's way better. I used to think my favorite things to do would be to get high and play the synthesizer, which is psychedelic and lots of fun. And maybe it's just because now I'm a 41-year-old old man, this is just what we like. I'll tell you, getting stoned and grilling, throwing in wood chips, and playing with the vents on my convection oven grill that looks like some kind of green spaceship, it really is one of my favorite things on earth. Slathering barbecue sauce on, watching how hot the thing instantaneously gets. You can cook pizza on the thing. I'm not sponsored by them, but if you are, for whatever reason, in the market for a grill, even though summer is over, go get a Big Green Egg through the Amazon portal. It's wonderful. It really is. It makes you feel good for some reason to cook with fire. It plugs into some deep, primordial, genetic part of whatever it is that we are. I don't know, maybe it doesn't at all, but it's a blast. So thank you guys who use the portal and who bookmark the portal. And thank you to all of you who continue to donate to the show. And thank you to all of you who continue to listen. I've been trying to get today's interview to happen for a little over a year. I made a list some time ago of the top 10 people I'd like to interview on this podcast. And on that list was Jim Woodring. Jim Woodring is an artist who creates the Frank comics. If you have been so unfortunate as to have never come into contact with Frank or the Unifactor, I invite you to go to your local comic book store or go on Amazon and order any of the Frank books immediately. They're the most beautiful, psychedelic, incredible works of art and storytelling that I've ever come across in my life. And after reading through the Frank comics, I started looking into Jim Woodring and was delighted to find that he was as mystical as his creation. And so about a year ago, I reached out to him. We weren't able to pull the interview off because he is a busy, wildly successful artist. But a few weeks ago, I reached out to him again, and he gave me the honor of this interview that you're about to hear. Go visit his website at jimwoodring.com, and I command you to immediately go to amazon.com or one of your local comic book shops and pick up as many copies of the Frank comics that you can find. They're going to help you decode the alien language that is wound up inside your very being. Now everyone, please get those pineal glands engorged and squirt some of your sweet astral nectar in the direction of today's guest, artist and visionary, Jim Woodring! Thank you so much for being on the show. This is I've been looking forward to this. I think I've been trying to get an interview with you for about a year now, and I really appreciate you taking the time to have a conversation with me.
Well, thanks, Duncan. And I wasn't trying to avoid you. If it seemed that way, I apologize. It's been a hectic year for me, and it's been hard for me to do anything outside my normal routine.
You've been working really hard, huh? Is this the you've been spending some time working on the upcoming 3D Frank book?
Oh, that's done. That's in the bag. That's coming out later this year.
So, what were you working on this year?
Well, for one thing, I moved, and that was a huge upheaval. Other than that, I've just been doing what I ordinarily do, drawing and painting and doing comics and trying to figure out how to produce something that somebody will want enough to give me some money for so I can continue to do it.
Right. Yeah, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going to start off on a sentimental note here, and I hope you'll forgive me for it, and maybe
sure.
I'll cut it out because it's kind of sentimental. But, man, in 2013, my mom was dying, and I was doing stand-up, and somebody at one of my shows brought me the portable Frank, and I'd never seen Frank before, and so I got this really cool graphic novel, your graphic novel, and I remember putting my suitcase, and I didn't think much of it. I didn't read it, I just had this thing that I could look at some point. But anyway, my mom passed away, and for whatever reason, I pulled out that book, and I gotta tell you, I don't know what it is, but something about the Unifactor and Frank meeting me in this intense moment in my life has created an infinite connection with your art, and I just want to thank you for it.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's a remarkable story. And needless to say, it warms my heart to hear it. Thanks very much.
Cool, man. I was hoping that maybe you could, just for the folks listening who might not be familiar with your work, if you could explain who Frank is.
You know, that's really a tall order. One of the big problems that I have is when I meet people and they ask what I do and I say I'm a cartoonist. That is a big turnoff to most people, and I'm in a hurry after that to say that I'm actually a worthwhile cartoonist, that I do work that adults can look at and enjoy, that I do work that is appealing to seekers out of mystery and aficionados of dark corners and
yes.
What might be hiding in them, and also people who share an interest, which, just a second, please. People who share an interest in some sort of personal investigation into what is actually going on here.
Yes.
Which is the driving spirit behind the Frank comics, I guess you could say. And it's also the main work of my life. To a real extent, To a large extent, my work is a reflection of my personal ethos and my I hate to use this phrase, but my life's path. Mm. And my work combine very closely, and they have frequently informed and influenced each other. So all that is by way of saying that I'm not trying to be an entertainer. I'm not trying to be, although I guess I am in a certain way, because if my work isn't on some level entertaining, nobody will buy it. But I'm not trying to be an entertainer, and I'm not trying to produce a hit series or anything like that. I'm trying to express how I feel about the world.
It feels to me like you're some kind of, I'm going to amplify it even more. It feels like you're some kind of visionary prophet, that the Frank books gave me the same feeling I get when I read the Bhagavad Gita. It's the same kind of sense of contact with some transcendent message that needs to be decoded and can't totally be decoded. That's what I love about it, is, you know, I can go to the Bhagavad Gita, I can open it up to any passage, and I can spend all day long thinking about that particular passage. And forgive me, I don't mean to sound like I'm blowing too much smoke here, but I can go to the Frank books. They're parables, you know? There's some kind of mysterious parable that I won't pretend to understand completely, but it fills me with that same sense of, I'm in deep water here. Do you feel like you're channeling this stuff?
Well, first of all, let me say, that I too am a big fan of the Bhagavad Gita. I keep a copy around and I pick it up and look at it at odd moments just to see with what I read at that moment will tell me. And it's always something. That is the book of books. And as far as what I do goes, I guess I may as well just come right out and say something, which I'm reluctant to say, which is that I think I am a mystic.
Yes, for sure.
Which is not the same as being a prophet or a seer or a wise man or a holy man or anything like that. A mystic is, there's lots and lots of mystics, and mystics are simply people who are attuned to the mystical or the occult or the arcane or whatever it is you want to call it. I definitely have that orientation, and I've had it my whole life, and it has, if I could have handled it better, it would have been great, but it's actually caused me a certain amount of grief because I haven't really known how to see or handle or harness this runaway interest in the hidden realm.
Well, isn't this one of the pitfalls they say that happens to people who get afflicted with those kinds of predilections, is that because you've gained access to whatever this energy source is, it drives people insane. It can drive you crazy. Like, you can lose your mind completely. And, because whatever the power line is that you've managed to grab, it's alive. And sometimes it's not so merciful with people. How do you feel it's negatively impacted your life?
Well, only socially, only by making me sufficiently confused by not only the world, but my own reactions to it, that it made me not exactly antisocial, but socially out of step with the world around me. I grew up in a very conservative environment in Southern California among people who had zero interest in this kind of thing.
Religious conservative or
social? Well, politically conservative. Glendale, California, Lily White.
Yes.
Dullesville, you know?
Yep.
And, if I had known somebody who, if they saw me struggling with this stuff, had said at that time, for example, oh, you should read the Bhagavad Gita, or you should pick up a book on Sri Ramana Maharshi or Sri Ramakrishna, or anybody who could have made me realize that there was a codified world of approaches to this kind of thing, I would have been a lot better off. But as it was, I was just a square peg in a round hole, and all I felt was different and weird and definitely unappreciated, but also unaccepted.
This is one of the big downfalls of incarnating in the West, isn't it? Is that you if you're born into a family that isn't familiar with the symbol systems available in a lot of the Eastern scriptures and Eastern mythologies, you will feel completely lost, because no one in I'm sure people in Glendale have the maps, but I know that, I mean, when I have a very similar story. When I was growing up, I didn't come into contact with that information until I was in high school or so. And then once you find it, you realize, oh, this is it. This is it. But when did you come into contact with those kinds of scriptures or philosophies for the first time?
The first time? You know, I can't even really say. I remember when I was a little kid, my folks, who were not particularly religious, thought that I should go to Sunday school. And that was okay with me, because I'd heard that you learned about God in Sunday school, and that appealed to me. But when I was actually there, I didn't really learn anything about God. I learned about Jesus in so much as he was watching over us and very worried about our sinful ways.
Yes.
And I learned about Daniel and the lion's den and the jawbone of the ass and the walls came tumbling down and all this crap I didn't care about. I wanted to hear about, you know, mysterious things. I wanted to hear about God. And I can see how people who are born into a Christian tradition who want to go beyond it can find it very difficult to do that, because Christian mysticism is actually buried pretty deep.
Yes.
And there are lots of great Christian mystic scriptures, but they're not up front. People aren't saying, you've got to read this, it'll show you the path to God.
What are some examples of those mystics? Meister Eckhart, maybe, or
Meister Eckhart, The Imitation of Christ by St. John of the Cross, the Confessions of St. Augustine, things like that.
That's some heavy stuff. That's the real Christianity to me. That's the real deal. That's it. Everything else seems kind of just like the very, very surface level of this incredibly deep fractal.
Well, I think that most people, the overwhelming majority of people, are not. This is going to sound like an insult, but I can't think of any other way to say it. They're not really cut out for religion. A serious religious practitioner is rare. A person who really takes the religious seriously from the standpoint of devoting lonely hours to sitting in meditation and contemplation and to trying to, you know, change their character so that they can change their mind, so that they can purify their mind and all those Vedantic things. I forget how I started that sentence, but people who really want to do that are not all that common.
Have you done that?
I have worked at it. I don't, you know, you said something earlier about how do I cope having access to these thoughts. I don't really. I have an interest in them. And I have a practice which brings me slowly, incrementally closer to understanding. I can feel that. But I don't have any kind of religious authority whatsoever. I just have enough interest in it to express that interest in a way that is intriguing, at least to me.
Can you talk a little bit about your practice?
Well, I can. I can say that you asked me when the first time I saw a scripture was, you know, when I started realizing that there were answers out there, I started trying to find them. And I found the Hare Krishna version of the Bhagavad Gita as it is.
Yep. Which,
is very Christian in its emphasis on punishment for your wicked ways.
Right.
And I didn't care for that, although I love the paintings, especially the woman boiling in oil for cooking a chicken.
Oh my gosh. Or the one where the guy, the cooking a chicken lady's good. The sleeping bear, was that in yours?
I don't recall the sleeping bear.
Oh, it's a good one. It's, if you sleep too much, you'll incarnate as a bear. And it's it shows like a woman sleeping. And then underneath, I guess, is this kind of depressed looking bear that I guess that's her next life. There was the butcher who's like got a cow's head, really trippy fundamentalist Christian style Hinduism in that book for sure.
Yeah, I like that. And they take the Hindu cosmology very seriously. His divine grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta, whatever his name was.
Swami Prabhupada.
Yes, he was, he those books, maybe even that book, I mean, he talks about the sour milk sea and this all that, you know, all that kind of stuff, which is maybe interesting and maybe not, but certainly irrelevant if what you're trying to do is meditate.
Well, right. I mean, isn't that the, it's interesting. I just had a Hare Krishna Swami on the last episode and, very wonderful person, beautiful, beautiful guy. Chanting Hare Krishna is just incredible, you know? And I remember when I came into contact with the Hare Krishnas, I didn't know that bhakti yoga or that mantra is way older than the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And it was really exciting to realize, oh, there's all these other forms of bhakti out there, not just the fundamentalist stuff that you see in the Bhagavad Gita as it is, but that fixation on the minutiae of Hindu mythology can be really annoying. And I actually have been to Vrindavan in India, and I can remember watching these monks in robes getting into a rather heated argument over some obvious mythology, like what you're saying, you know, like what would the composition of that ocean be, or what would it feel like in your hand, like stuff like that, where it seems to be at first glance missing the point. But this Hare Krishna that I interviewed, the way he put it is, all of that stuff is designed as a meditation to take up all your thought processes. You know, you're sort of surrendering all of your thought processes into this, what I would consider to be pretty absurd symbolism. But from that, you can hit some kind of transcendent platform, I guess.
Well, that makes perfect sense. And it's obviously just exactly the right path for some people.
Right.
It's not mine. And I know that, you know, all the things that I believe in and think about and chant, meditate on, and unquestionably the Hare Krishna mantra is a great one to chant. It's a wonderful use of your time. But the things that make sense to me, and which make so much sense that they constitute a superior reality, are just so much nonsense to my friends. I don't know anybody really outside of the people who are connected to Vedanta, and they are not in my normal circle of friends. I don't know anybody who is interested in the stuff that I'm in this religious stuff.
Yeah.
And they think, you know, I don't ever talk about it, but on the occasions where it comes up and I do talk about it, they think I'm crazy for believing in this stuff. It seems as childish and as stupid to them as the idea of, you know, the virgin birth or infant damnation does to me.
Oh, so you're saying when you come into contact with Christians and they hear that you have...
No, I'm talking about secular people.
Like, what is an example of some of your beliefs that they take issue with?
Well, they just take issue with the whole thing. They don't like it. They don't like religion. And I can understand why they don't like religion. If you don't feel the call and all you see of religion is what it does in the world, it's perfectly natural to hate it, think it's a malign force that is doing infinitely more harm than good.
Sometimes I wonder if that's a force field intentionally placed there to filter people out. Because it seems like what that's doing is it's filtering out people who see things only on the surface. And it's this really kind of genius mechanism, isn't it? Because it's what ends up happening is all these people look at the surface level of the thing. And yeah, if you look at the surface level, you watch the news and you allow that to take up your entire... take up your entire view of what religion is, and yeah, why would you want to bother with it? It's some kind of miserable, life-destroying, thought-corrupting, ultimately violent waste of your incarnation. But man, it sure isn't. That's not what it is at all. And I know what you mean. It's very frustrating when you realize people don't want to push through that membrane and just allow themselves to suspend their disbelief in the same way they do when they watch a Star Wars movie.
I think you have to feel inwardly, there has to be some part of you that responds when you hear something, that is always looking, and when it hears something that's true and that resonates, it picks up on it and it wants to get closer to it.
Right.
I always feel that, like, for me, one of the distinctions is people will go out in the wilderness and they'll see some awe-inspiring thing, and they'll feel a sense of holiness. Right. They'll feel a connection to the cosmos. They'll feel overwhelming awareness of how fantastic and beautiful the universe is. But some of us instinctively get down on our knees and say, "You're fantastic. I want to know you better. I get it. Bring me in deeper. I want to go forward. This is a fantastic billboard you've got here. What are you advertising exactly? Show me. Bring me in."
Wow.
And when you start looking into how you have to do that, you realize the meaning behind all these words. The idea of renunciation is appalling to most people.
Yes.
But if you look at it in the context of what it means in order to have a spiritual life, it means that you have to train your mind not to be absorbed in the real world. You have to teach your mind to regard it as something to be scorned, something that's not important, something that gets in the way, something that has to be dealt with. But you renounce it in the same way that you now renounce cigarettes if you're quitting smoking. You say, "I've got to stop doing this because I want this higher thing that I can get from quitting this." Right. And it's so hard to do, and people have to do it gradually, and how many decades does it take for a person typically to get anywhere solid through meditation?
Well, and that to me has always been something very frustrating and something I wonder about, that idea that the process takes years and years and years, because you hear these stories, especially in Zen, of people like, a drop of water hits a puddle and bam, they wake up. Or, you hear these varying stories. But yeah, as someone who has a predilection to laziness, I just hate that idea that, yeah, this, just like anything else in the world, takes years and years and years to accomplish.
Yeah. Well, that can be daunting. But, there's the parable of the master who has two students, and they say, "How long will it take me to attain enlightenment?" And the master points to an enormous tamarind tree in full bloom, and he goes, "It'll take you as many years as there are leaves on that tree, as many lives."
Yeah.
It's on that tree. And the one disciple goes, "Oh my God, that'll take forever." And the other one goes, "Really? That's all?"
That's so cool.
It's just a matter of perspective.
Right. Because the more you're fixated on this life, and the more you're fixated on the minutiae of this life, then of course a tree filled with leaves that represent incarnations is going to seem enormous. But if you recognize that we're all an infinite consciousness that isn't really in the time-space continuum, it's just confused by it or fixated on it, then yeah, that's nothing. Big
it
deal.
Is. And just being told, "Oh, your journey is finite. There will be an end to it," by an authority that you respect, that would be a huge comfort for someone who's, looking at it in that way.
Right. Yeah. That.
Another thing about this that's interesting to me is how I know people who have gotten onto the path and never deviated and have become monk-like in their, or actual monks. But I've never been that way. My mind is very, very squirrely, like I think most people's are. And the experience of getting into a practice and sitting in meditation and being into it for reasons you cannot say, and getting results, which are very slight, but you know them when they happen because they belong to a different order of experience. If there's something that happens to people who meditate fairly early in the game, usually called, experiencing the white light. When that happens to people, and it happens in varying degrees, it's a sign, because it's not light and it's not like anything you've ever experienced. It's a kind of radiance, and it's accompanied by a kind of soul warmth. And you say, "Oh, this is an emissary from that country I want to go to. This is off the spectrum of normal human experience. My mind has gotten just a tiny bit refined, and as a result, it's experiencing this very slight awareness of something transcendental.
Does stuff like that ever make you want to put on the brakes?
No, never. I think one of the things about meditating is that it's the only experience I've ever had where it does not contain a duality with it within itself, where it wasn't good and bad at the same time. It was only good. Mm. You know, like you get, something's delicious. You're hungry and you eat a cookie. It's great. You eat 20 of them and you feel sick.
Right.
Or if you you meet a girl and you're crazy about her and you have this fantastic relationship, usually it isn't long before things start to go south and that love turns into a torment.
Right.
Unless you learn how to be selfish and change your selfless and change your perspective and do things differently. If you just fall in love and don't do anything but try to have that love forever, it'll turn into a nightmare. It's
That's
inevitable.
Right.
But you can meditate day in and day out if you have the strength, and it doesn't turn bad. It doesn't turn into something unpleasant. Your mind may get tired. Your body may rebel. But you never feel like, God, I overdid it. Now I feel sick. I had too much. It's always good.
Oh, yeah, right. There's no meditation hangovers.
No, yeah, and there's no sense that you've pushed it past the point where it was good. There's only the sense that you haven't gone far enough deep into it to experience more good, which you would like.
You never hear about people getting dragged into mental hospitals because they meditated too much, and there's no Meditators Anonymous of people starting to quit meditating.
No, but there are people who have injured their minds by practicing incorrectly, by doing pranayama wrong or something. People hurt themselves by doing skull shining and you know, bellows breathing and that kind of stuff.
What is skull shining?
Skull shining is it's a form of pranayama, very intense. It's kind of like hyperventilating, but it's one of those things they exhort you to do very, very carefully. And I know people who have had psychotic episodes that they never recovered from doing that.
Who has taught you this stuff? Do you have an active teacher?
I do. I have an affiliation with Sri Ramakrishna, and I have a teacher, if you want to use that word, who is a senior monk of the Ramakrishna order, a venerable man, let's just call him that, who is my guide.
You say, let's just call him that because it's not quite a man, right? It's more.
No, he's a man. He's a man. You know, there's a word, guru, which is, I don't think, understood and maybe best not used in casual conversation.
Right.
Which you and I are not necessarily having, but since this is for.
Oh, don't worry. People on this podcast.
People don't know what a guru is. A guru, a real guru, bona fide guru, is the single most important connection you will ever have with a human being in your life. He can love you more than your parents were capable of. He can help you more than anybody else can. And he has your interests at heart in a selfless way that is beyond the capacity of any normal human being.
Yeah. And you don't get, I mean, it's a very rare thing to come into contact with a guru. Like that's considered to be a very auspicious and very good karma. Not everybody gets that in a lifetime.
Well, I have a feeling that everybody who should get it gets it. You know, they say that the three great blessings are to be born as a human being, to be born with an appetite for religion, and to meet your teacher. They say that's the trio of auspicious things that can happen to a person who's interested in the spiritual life.
Right.
And there's a fourth thing, which I think is essential, and that is to be a very good aspirant if you want to get the most out of it. And I'm not. One of the things that really intrigues me is how my meditation over the years has been very, very spotty. I'll do it. I'll really get into it. I'll really think I'm going places. I will be going places. And then the desire to do it just leaves me. And sitting in front of the altar is a trial.
Yes.
And I just get up and I go away and I feel all charged up. I'm very light. I'm feeling very good. I've got tons of good energy. And eventually that dissipates. And I end up crawling back and sitting in front of the altar again and going, oh, God, how do I do this again? What is it I'm trying to do? And it comes back and I think, why did I ever leave this? And that's happened to me so many times during the course of my life. And I think it's common. I think that's much more common than being an ever perfect, as Sri Ramakrishna called him, somebody who is born to be a renunciate, born without a strong libido, born without a strong attachment to the world, born with the intellectual capability to look around at the world and see at an early age that it never satisfies.
Yeah.
Even in the long terms, to say nothing of permanently.
Yeah, those guys are boring.
No, I don't think they're boring. They may be boring, but they've got it going on.
I mean boring in the sense I'm being a player hater, of course.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, that's it. And they are. People can't see them.
Yeah.
People look at people. Generally speaking, they're invisible to the world because they aren't making noise and making waves.
Not interested. They're not interested. And I'm fascinated. You know, I love thinking about them because when you consider sort of societally this crazy hierarchy that we have in society and popular culture, you know, like we have this spectrum of celebrity or fame. And I don't know if do you use Instagram?
No.
So Instagram is this, I love it. It's this ridiculous thing where people post pictures. And if you follow Taylor Swift on Instagram, then what you're going to get is a lot of pictures of her pre-show, sort of taking pictures of the massive arena that she's about to perform in, and then pictures of the arena while she's performing, just countless people, just an impossible to imagine, almost like Adolf Hitler level swarm of people watching her. And you see she's the nucleus of this incredible organism that's formed around her. So Taylor Swift, you could say, is on the very end of this weird spectrum of fame. But what you're talking about, these people who aren't stirring up the sediment of culture, but are a million times more potent than a Taylor Swift. I love thinking about how far does that spectrum go, and where are they? How are they spending their time? What are their interests here? Why did they come here? Why do you think they even came here at all?
That's a question I can't answer. One of the things that really took me a while to get my mind around when I met my teacher was when he initiated me, he said, okay, our relationship will be teacher and student. And I said, good. And I didn't really realize what that meant. He isn't interested in hearing what I have to say about anything unless I'm asking him a question or trying to clarify some spiritual point. Mm-hmm. He doesn't give a hoot about my artwork or my situation at home or what I saw on the street or a joke that I've heard or my thoughts about Vedanta. All he does is tell me things. And he is such an authority that he doesn't utter an unconsidered or wasteful syllable. And the instruction can be really dry, and it really frequently isn't what I want. I grew up reading lush, exciting things like, Be Here Now or the books of Alan Watts and things that really try to kind of put their arm around you and bring you into this field of thought. But a real teacher, at least the one I've encountered, doesn't do that at all. He has information and he wants me to understand it, and there are no frills, no wasted time, no social niceties whatsoever. But everything he says is intended to bring me closer to the goal, and he's got the insight. He's got so much insight and so understanding that his words have power. And if he tells me to sit down and say a certain mantra, that has a lot of meaning, and the doing of it will get different results than if somebody else told me to do that and I sat down and tried it. There's a connection there that is incomprehensible. And sometimes I will find myself, I'll pull back from this a little bit and I'll go, what am I actually doing here? I can say that I feel I have a connection with Sri Ramakrishna. I feel it. What does that even mean? where did this connection come from? Did I know him in a past life? Are we connecting on the astral plane or whatever? I don't know what that even means. I don't know what any of this stuff means, but I'm dancing to the tune that it's calling because it is far and away not only the only thing in my life that makes sense, but the only thing in my life that seems worth doing. Everything else is just cyclical, wheel spinning, time killing, you know, the road to superannuation. It doesn't get me anywhere. Drugs don't get you anywhere. Art doesn't get you anywhere. Romantic love doesn't get you anywhere.
Wow.
Contemplation and meditation and trying to purify your mind so that it can understand transcendental things, that gets you somewhere.
Do you know the story? It's a Hare Krishna story about the dog that has no teeth. Have you heard that story before?
I don't think so. It sounds sad.
It's really sad. And it's a comparison to people who think you can achieve pleasure in the material universe from gratifying the senses. But the idea is there's a dog in a village with no teeth, and it's found a dry bone, and it's chewing on the dry bone with its gums, and the dry bone is cutting its gums, so it's tasting its own blood, and it keeps chewing on the bone because it's confused drinking its own blood with eating food.
Oh, that's amazing.
Isn't that cool? And that's the comparison for what everyone's doing here, which is that they're eating plastic fruit, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's a similar parable in the Ramakrishna tradition, different, but similar in a certain way, which is that a camel, one of the camel's favorite foods evidently is a kind of thorny plant, and it hurts it to eat it. The thorns hurt its mouth, and it bleeds while it's eating it, but it won't stop doing it.
Right.
And, that's something I certainly see in my own life and in the lives of people around me. We're drawn to make the same mistakes over and over again and to suffer in the same way again. And it's interesting to contemplate why it is that happens. What is it about this world that is so alluring that we're determined to squeeze pleasure out of it over and over again, even though we know that it always ends in tears? And contrarywise, why is it that, for me at least, it can be so, if I'm in the zone, and meditating is a complete pleasure. But that zone eventually goes away, and I cannot get into it. And I wonder, why is that? What is it in me that is holding up a hand and saying, stop, no more meditation. It's time to go out and smoke pot and overeat and get in trouble somehow, you know?
Yes.
It's like, I don't know why I have to keep taking these vacations from my practice just to wallow like a pig in the filth of the world, but I do. I can't help it. And I think it's because the pleasures of spiritual living, at least at the stage that I'm in, are so subtle and so I don't quite trust them. If I'm meditating well and living well and controlling my mind, I feel good, but it's a very placid kind of well-being. Now, what I want is to take LSD or something and have some mind-blowing experience.
Right.
It's hard for me to be satisfied with just feeling calm and a low-level peace.
Well, you know, maybe the experience, the reason you're doing it is because you really enjoy that feeling when you come back to the practice. And maybe that's your version of that explosive thing. Because there's a, you know, Sharon Salzberg, the Buddhist teacher.
No, I don't.
She's pretty great, but she's got a saying, the healing is in the return. And that it's that moment that when you leave your practice and you experience all the confusion and stagnation that comes from being disconnected from a practice, and then suddenly you're sitting again and you get that first, what you described is, why did I ever stop doing this? It's incredible. Maybe that's what we like. Maybe it's that, I don't know, maybe there's, you know, it's like the child running away from its mom and then coming back again. There's a kind of bliss in that moment when you come back to it.
Yeah, definitely. But there's also a certain bliss in the moment where you decide, okay, I've been meditating long enough. I've been a good boy long enough. I mean, when the thrill goes away, there's nothing. I don't have the discipline. And I think the real difference is that a really deep, really naturally, spiritually endowed person will sit at that altar every day, whether they feel like it or not.
Right.
And I think they may also have the inherent blessing of not having a raging desire to get high or get laid or whatever it is that pulls me away from the practice.
Well, do you think, Jim, that it's possible that there is no escape from the altar? I mean, some people say that the getting laid, getting high, gratifying the senses, if approached from the right, with the right intention, becomes as valid a method as meditating.
Yeah. Well, is that true? I mean, it may be true for some people. People I've known who did that, and they were a sort of autodidactic tantrics, were assholes. And I don't want to be, you know, it doesn't strike me as being a very good thing.
I haven't pulled it off. I can't. I mean, I think you could be maybe a, you know, you would have to be a, I don't know. It's like an amphibious creature. So you'd have to, I don't know how you go into that place and maintain any kind of lucidity at all. I can't. The moment that I go away from a practice for any given amount of time, I become comatose. I'm just an ambient sleepwalker. I don't know what's happening. I just stumble around until I'm lucky enough that I'm sitting again.
Hmm. Well, you know, on the one hand, there are, you know, paths like that, you know, extreme tantra or agora. You know, they're not my paths. They're interesting to me, but they don't they don't resonate with me, and I can just tell they're not for me.
Oh gosh, drinking out of a skull.
Well, that idea appeals to me, although I can't touch wine. But we're sitting on a corpse in the cemetery. I mean, I like that idea down by the old burning gap, you know?
Yeah.
I like that. And I guess you had an opportunity to do that when you were in Benares.
I saw it. I didn't have an opportunity to do it, but I saw it. Have you ever been to India?
No, I never have.
Oh, you gotta go, man. You gotta go. You go to Varanasi. My friend and I, we were in India and in Varanasi, the city of Shiva. They, because it's Shiva City, Shiva eats marijuana. So you can get marijuana there as a sacrament. And we, you know, everyone had been telling us, when you get to Varanasi, order a bong lassi. And, you know, college kids didn't really think about it at all. Ordered a bong lassi at our hotel, drank it, then got on a boat on the Ganges River just as the marijuana was kicking in. And talk about getting your ass kicked by God. Just like, what did you think you were doing? Like, you are now on this most sacred river on earth in the city of what they call the city of burning and learning, because it's just everyone's getting cremated there. Yeah, and it was amazing. And you see these Shaivites in the water ringing bells, and smoke is rising up from bodies being cremated, and people are dancing around the bodies being cremated, chanting, and monkeys are running on the rooftop, and it's just another dimension. You are in another dimension. That's not the one we're in right now.
Well, I would love to go there and see something like that. If I ever do make it to India, the first place I'm going to go to is Dakshineswar to see the Kali temple there.
What is this? I've never heard of this.
The Kali Temple in Dakshineswar. You know Sri Ramakrishna? Are you aware of him?
I'm aware of him, but as soon as I'm done with this interview, I'm going to start researching him. I don't know too much about him.
Well, he was a temple priest at the Kali Temple at Dakshineswar. So he lived there, and it's a place of pilgrimage for people like me. So that's the main place that I would like to go. But of course, there are lots of other places in India like Benares that I would love to go to.
How much of this philosophy and how much of Ramakrishna has made its way into the Frank books?
Well, probably, you know, that's a question I can't really answer, because I have to assume that Sri Ramakrishna has always been there in my life, and I just became aware of him at a certain point when I was about 35.
So Frank existed prior to your contact.
No, he didn't. Well, I guess he did. I don't know. Frank is a manifestation of my own way of seeing things. And before I did Frank, I did other work in the same vein that also strove to express the things that Frank's drove, but Frank really turned out to be a perfect Blue Moon vehicle for that. And I actually did the first drawing I ever did of Frank very shortly after encountering Sri Ramakrishna. So maybe he is some sort of a flowering of that. I don't know.
Wow. So Frank came. Oh, wow. Cool.
But I think that may be putting too much emphasis on it, because I don't really think that. I mean, I think my work is best viewed completely divorced from anything having to do with Vedanta or religion or anything real. Because what these are comic fables.
Right.
And they're just, you know, by someone who is not a seer and not enlightened, and they should never be taken as having any depth or serious meaning to them. People who are possessed of knowledge of certain kinds of depth and meaning might find something resonating in those books that entertains them or intrigues them. Or people who are at the very, very beginning of their own voyage of self-discovery might respond to Frank more than they respond to Sunday school, because there are spiritual mysteries and parables and cosmic cause and effect and things like that built into there.
Oh, yes. I see. It's so funny. It doesn't matter if you say that. I'm still going to find deep meaning in those books, whether you like it or not. I love them.
That's fine with me.
Thank you.
That's fine with me. I'm just saying that from my point, as I represent it, from my standpoint, I cannot, you know, I can't say, oh, yeah, these are spiritual comics. These comics are full of, you know, cosmic wisdom, which I have gleaned and now I'm sharing with you. That's absurd. I could never, ever say that. That's crazy.
Well, I mean, maybe it just accidentally comes out of you, or maybe it's just something some of us are projecting onto it because we want it to be there. But
well, I think it, you know, it's when I write these stories, when I write a Frank story, I've got this criterion that I developed where, and it goes back to the earliest things I ever saw that had resonance for me. You know, when I was a little kid, like I say, I grew up in a very conservative household, but I would occasionally see things that got me where I lived. I would see a Hieronymus Bosch print, or I would see an illustration by Boris Artsebashev in Time magazine, or I would see an illustration by Pierre Roy or some other kind of illustrator whose work hovered on the boundary line between secular and spiritual. And I would think those images are got something. I want to do that. I want to try to make pictures that have that quality to them. And it wasn't until I was in high school that I found out about surrealism. And the way I found out about it was by going to a massive surrealism and Dada retrospective at the LA County Art Museum in 1968 when I was 16. I'd never even heard of Salvador Dali. And I walked place, and there's all the greatest hits of Dada and Surrealism. And the Dali section, which was about in the middle of the show, had maybe 10 of his best and most famous paintings, including The Invisible Man. And I remember looking at The Invisible Man and seeing one of those flayed Gradivas hanging from a plinth by her hair.
Yeah.
With her face turned away from you as if in shame. And that just went into my subconscious like a bullet and exploded. And I realized what could be done with art, how deep it could go, how scary and wrong and bad and sick and glorious it could be if you had sufficient courage to face these things and to put them down and to obviously not give a shit whether or not people thought you were crazy or wrong or perverted or anything.
Right.
That was a very liberating experience. It was like all these men and women who I hadn't known their life existed before saying, yes, by all means, explore these mysteries. By all means, devote your life to this kind of thing. So that was a huge eye opener for me there. And what I realized is that there's a certain kind of frisson I get from a certain kind of work where I can, it just attracts me and it holds my eye. And the analogy that I came up with to explain it to myself is that it's like fluorescence.
Yes.
Because you can't see fluorescent light, but it makes things glow. So you can tell that those rays are there by the way certain substances react. And when I'm writing a Frank story, I will come up with ideas one after another. And when I get one that has that glow to it, I'll start exploring that. And the ideas that I add to that initial idea I don't keep them unless they have that glow also. And by the end of it, I've got this long glowing chain of events, and I don't worry about what it means or anything. I just draw it up. And if I'm lucky, I never do discover the meaning of it until, well, if I'm lucky, I never discover it, so it never loses its punch for me. Over time, I frequently find out what a lot of them are about. Some of them are quite mundane. But
really? Mundane? No kidding. Like, how do you mean?
Well, I mean, they're mundane. For example, there's one where there's this, the whole thing can be explained by a central pun, which is the relationship between the words rug and drug. That's a little bit disappointing, but then again, drugs, that's not a small subject, drugs.
Right.
And neither is rugs, if you want to look at it in a certain way. So
no, I rugs aren't at all.
Gurdjieff, it's one thing to say that, oh yeah, this book is about how, every individual consciousness is a reflection of Brahman. That sounds very interesting and highfalutin and easy to contemplate. But, you know, that's not a message I would ever deliberately try to say. I would never say, you know, this is an interesting idea. I'll try to express this tenet of Vedanta in my work. That never occurs to me. I just conjure up ideas until one of them announces its significance by having that glow. And I just put it in a jar and accumulate things until I can make a story out of them.
Wow. Do you, when you say you write the Frank books or you're coming up with these potential ideas, are you verbally, are you writing them out as a script?
Yeah.
Or you're okay.
Yeah. I write them in pencil in a notebook.
So you write out Frank does this or this.
Yes, exactly.
Wow. Cool. And then if that fluoresces for you, then you'll start drawing it.
Yeah. If I have a complete story, I will just sit down and breaking it down, drawing it up, all that stuff is kind of fun. But by the time I'm ready to sit down and actually draw it and draw those wavy lines and everything, all the fun part of it is gone and it's just work.
Oh, wow. Right. Yes. Because it's so precise what you're doing. I could see that. It's almost like a wood cutting, or it's incredible. Jim, we only have about 9 more minutes left, and I've got a couple of questions from the internet for you. May I ask them? I asked people if they had questions for you.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I picked out two that I really love. Please ask him how he manages to so successfully stay tuned to his subconscious mind.
How do I? I guess by trying to, and by sacrificing a lot of my life in order to do it. You know, when I was the things I think lots of people have all kinds of dynamic experiences when they're very young. They hallucinate, they experience paranoia, they have a very vivid, wild, untamed, exciting, and mysterious view of the world.
Right.
And that gradually goes away with time because they realize that if they want to get an education, get a job, get married, get buried, they have to leave all that stuff behind because it won't help them on that quest. But for me, that was those feelings, that intensity, that was the only thing that ever mattered to me. And I've worked my whole life at keeping that tunnel open and my line of sight back down through the years to that kind of early cauldron of experiences open. And so the answer is how I do it is I work at it. I've sacrificed dignity and time and a lot of other things just so that I can maintain that connection.
What do you mean dignity? How do you sacrifice dignity in that pursuit?
Well, I guess I didn't have to, but I just ended up doing it because I was a monomaniac. You know, a person who, you know, it's like somebody who's in the throes of creation. They don't really care whether their hair is combed or whether they've showered or wearing their pants are inside out. They just want to, they're just focused on the work. And I've sort of been that way my whole life in my pursuit of the enjoyment and the slow unfolding understanding of what all this means. So I haven't tried to, I had never learned decorum. I could never have gone to finishing school. I never really cared much about how I dressed, and to a certain extent, I never cared about how I acted. And that all really worked against me in a social way.
Can you describe your workspace?
Well, we just moved from our beloved old house in Seattle's U District out to Vashon Island nearby. And so my workspace is brand new, but I have a small room that I draw in. And I have a work table that goes up and down so I can stand at it or sit at it. And it's got a big light table on it. And that's where I do all my drawing.
Is it true that you listen to crickets when you work?
No, I listen to frogs. And now I've got real frogs. I'm surrounded by tree frogs. So all I have to do is open the window. But yeah, I listen to recordings of frogs. And I also listen to spoken word. You know, you're talking about doing the artwork, and I was saying that the preparing it of it is easy, and the drawing it of it is hard. I can't listen to anything while I'm writing it. There has to be dead silence. But when I'm drawing it, I just listen to spoken word and old radio shows nonstop.
What spoken word do you listen to?
Oh, books on tape. I go to the library. I just got a bunch of books on tape by David Sedaris. I got a novel about Zelda Fitzgerald. I got Michael Moore's autobiography. I got John Lithgow's autobiography. I just burn through the stuff. I just like to hear human voices talking while I work.
Have you started listening to podcasts yet while you work? Not to be self-promoting.
I have listened to some podcasts, yes.
But no music. You don't listen to music while you're working?
Oh, yeah, I listen to music, too. I listen to loud classical and rock and roll music.
What kind of rock music do you listen to?
Oh, I still listen to Nirvana an awful lot. But you know, I'm not up on modern music. For me, the White Stripes is still a new band, so.
Same here.
I like rock and roll. I like guitars, drums, rhythm guitar. My son is always playing hip hop for me, and you know, Beyonce's great, and Andre 2000 is great. There's lots of great stuff out there. But what I really like is rock and roll and guitars. And with music, what I really like is, with classical music, what I like is lush, heavy, orchestral, programmatic music.
Jim, one last question. A lot of folks who listen to this podcast and a lot of folks listening right now are artists. And maybe they haven't had the same kind of courage you've had when it comes to allowing themselves just to go deep into whatever that soup or whatever the thing is that's coming out of you. Is there any kind of advice you could give them, methods they could use, some technique or tactic that they could adopt that will help them be more of a conduit for this kind of creative energy you're putting into the world?
No, I don't really know how to do that myself, so I couldn't give anybody else any advice to it. I will say that when I hear from a cartoonist who tells me that he wants to be a cartoonist and he's working at it, his wife is worried about where the money's coming from, so he's given himself 6 months or a year to succeed, and if it doesn't work out, he'll go back to whatever it was he was doing. I just tell him to go back to whatever he was doing now, because that attitude is counterindicated for people who want to succeed. The only way to succeed is to have no other options, no backup plan. I used to tell my wife and son, when he was old enough to understand what I was saying, that I was going to do this work, and if we had to live in the park and sleep on bales of hay, that was too bad, but I had to do this work, and there was no hope for it. Because I couldn't do anything else. Not only did I not have the skills, I couldn't focus on another career while I was thinking about this one.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Jim. I'm so grateful to you for this conversation. It's just been wonderful. Where can people find you? Is there, you have a website, jimwoodring.com?
I have a website, yeah, jimwoodring.com, which is sort of semi-moribund. Better than that, I have a Facebook artist page.
Great. I'll have that link up at duncantrussell.com. And do you have a book coming out in December 2015? Is there anything sooner than that coming out?
No. I was hoping that this book would come out sooner because there are some events it's related to. But no, the 3D book is coming out in December, and Right now, I'm working on a new Frank book, which is a sequel to my previous Frank book, which was called Fran. It starts where that one left off.
Oh, God, I love Fran. Man, that is my favorite one. I can't wait to see what happens.
I hope you like it, because I think what is going on here is interesting. There's a story structure and a literary device that I've never seen anywhere else before. And so I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
When can we expect it to come out?
I can't even begin to say. I'm still in the very early stages of working on it.
Can't wait. Jim, thank you so much. It's just been a great pleasure. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Duncan. You're an interesting guy to talk to.
Thank you for saying so. Great. All right. Wonderful. Thanks for listening, everybody. Please be sure to go to jimwoodring.com and to buy some Frank books, because they're the best. Also, big thanks to squarespace.com for sponsoring this podcast. If you go to Squarespace and use offer code Duncan, you'll get 10% off your first order. Bless you guys. Thank you so much for listening to the show. I'll see you real soon. Hare Krishna.